Hello, everyone. This is Mike Quincy connecting the light. We apologise about the late start, but our guest who confirmed he was available yesterday, we found had been admitted to hospital when we phoned him today, just before the programme. And I did have somebody standing by in case we couldn't contact him at all. It's Joseph Lumpkin, who we chanced our arm in contacting him to see if he could still fill in, and he's kindly arranged to do that, and I can't be more grateful, because he was driving along in his car and it's taken him a bit by surprise, but that's far better than having to repeat a programme. Joseph Lumpkin has investigated the question of the lost books of the Bible and those regarding the fallen angels, demons and the Nephilim, and he wants to talk about those. I'm certainly interested. Like you, I have read quite a bit of the Book of Enoch, so I'm interested in what he feels that meant, and also why these particular books were not included in the Bible. So I have a feeling we're going to have a very interesting discussion here. So having said all that, Joseph, can I welcome you to the program, and thank you so much for obliging us when we're in need.
Oh, no problem, Mike. Thank you for asking. And I apologize for the road noise. We're trying to find a place to pull off right now, going between the states of Tennessee and Virginia. Yeah. And you probably hear in the back that we've got a GPS going, so I'm going to cut that off and get some silence for us here.
Right.
So you want to discuss the Book of Enoch and why it did not appear in the Bible?
Yes, I would, because having read it, or not all of it, having read parts of it, I'm sort of half guessing, you're going to confirm whether this is true or not, that there were parts of it that perhaps didn't fit in with the Christian teachings, i.e. the occasion when Enoch was taken up. But you carry on from there.
Well, first let me say that the Book of Enoch actually does appear in a Bible. The problem is whose Bible we're talking about. The Book of Enoch and the Book of Jubilees appears in the Ethiopic Christian Bible. They have about 81 books in their canon. And therein lies part of the problem is why it didn't appear in our canon and it did in theirs. And, of course, you actually have just put your finger on the problem. If you were to look at the geography of the place, everything is swept down the Nile, so to speak, and Ethiopia lays down the Nile from where Christendom was being birthed. Now, they really were kind of excluded in a lot of ways from the different synods, the different meetings, and they were sort of, so to speak, to themselves. Almost like they were evolving slightly separately from the mainstream Christian religion of the time. And they weren't part of the basic power struggle going on. So what you had, generally speaking, was a power struggle going on, especially around Constantine's time, when the greater synods were being the enclaves were coming together and the people were trying to decide what to put in the Bible and what not. And they were evolving separately. And so we actually ran into different canon, different lists of scriptures. Ethiopian Christians tend to be more mystical and more open-minded to different things and not as myopic or tunnel vision. Because they didn't have a central body trying to control everything. So, yes, you're absolutely positively correct. In the major stream of Christendom at that time, you had a power struggle going on, and you had Christianity being defined by, of course, the parties in power. Mm. And that is why, and it did not fit into some of the thought processes at the time, and so it was excluded. It was, and what makes it so interesting is that the Book of Enoch is actually made up of three major sections, five sections all in all that kind of fit together, but three major sections. And the first section, the book of the Watchers, it's called, is actually quoted word for word in the book of Jude. And it's referred to in just plain bold references in the book of Peter. So you have this fundamental idea, this really fundamental proof, if you will, that Jude and Peter were reading the book at the time and considered it to be authentic, and they quoted from it and they referenced it. But then, 400 years later, when we've got what we think is a better idea of what Christianity should be, and the powers that be are trying to define what's going on, they decide that the book as a whole does not fit in. Does that make sense?
Yes, indeed.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was simply going to say that when Emperor Constantine was speaking with priests or the likes from other countries, I guess he had a particular format in mind that he wanted to make into the books of the Bible. So that gave him the opportunity to reject any books that didn't fit in with his version that he envisaged.
Yes, absolutely. And you have to understand why he was doing that, and it was truly a work of genius from a political standpoint. He said to himself, if I can unite Christianity, I can control Christianity. And if I can control Christianity and make the nation Christian, I can control the nation. So he was bringing together different factions of Christianity, and that's how we got to the Trinity. You had certain Christian strands, if you will, faiths, denominations we call them now, which believed that that the hypostasis, the substance of Jesus, was one thing, say spirit only. And you had others that believed that the hypostasis was flesh only, and they were able to come up with an idea of the Trinity to satisfy everybody. But the idea doesn't really appear that much in the Bible. It's hinted to, but you can't put your finger on it. And the reason you can't put your finger on it is it's man-made. It's a political structure to bring different factions together. And what makes it so really bad in a way is that when the priests, when the bishops concluded and went home and were outside the influence of the emperor again, they wrote letters to the emperor saying, we have sinned, we have given in to your threats, your strong arm tactics, and we have signed documents that we don't even believe in.
I mean, that has to be shocking news to those who still believe that the Bible is the Word of God, because it just shatters their beliefs.
Well, of course, I was brought up to believe that, but I have a question about that. But if people would ponder it, they would kind of understand. I suppose it comes in two forms. First of all, the Gospels are what they say they are. They are the proclamation of the good news. They are not supposed to be historically valid. They are people's diaries. And in being a person's diaries, they are not going to be that accurate. They're subjective. So here's the point. We are told that when Jesus died, the graves of the saints burst open, and the saints walked to the earth.
Yes.
My question to those people who are literalists are, or is, if that actually happened, if you saw Uncle Joshua walking around someplace, Uncle Simon walking around someplace that had been dead for 100 years,
yes,
wouldn't it be written down someplace in history? Wouldn't someone have made some reference to it that said, oh my goodness, this is what happened?
Yes.
But the historicity of such things is completely missing.
Yes, that does rather tell a tale, doesn't it, really?
It just gives one pause to think exactly what is going on. Then there are other things, Mike. For example, we know for a fact that there are at least four endings to the book of Mark. And it looks like Mark was probably destroyed by fire. The last page or two is probably destroyed probably by fire or something. It was somehow maimed. And so Mark ends at a particular point, and then the scribes came back and they said, well, this really doesn't have an ending. We've got to create something that's a good ending for this book. And so that part of Mark that says, if you drink poison, it won't hurt you. If you pick up serpents, it won't hurt you. You can heal the sick and raise the dead. That part actually is not in the oldest witnesses. And sadly, there are entire denominations that are created or based on those things, especially here in Alabama. We have a group of Christians that are called Sand Hill Christians, and they are snake handlers.
Oh yeah.
And every once in a while, one of them will get bit and they'll die. And of course, they say it's because that person didn't have the faith. In actuality, what they're practicing didn't exist at the time that the book was penned. It was added afterwards.
Yes. Well, we do get all these variations, don't we, in people's beliefs, and I think Christianity and its offshoots are full of different types of ritual. It's like, I guess, those people that speak in tongues, isn't it?
That's absolutely correct. And it really depends on, in my opinion, it's like the blind men handling the elephant. You know, one says it's a rope because it's handling the tail, and one says it's a serpent because it's handling the trunk, and one says it's a tree because it's handling the leg. And in our myopic view of God, it's much the same. And I believe if we would just relax and allow, then the Christian faith would get along a lot better than bickering among the different denominations.
Well, that's the point there when you mention God. I mean, is there generally agreement as to what God is?
I do not think there is. There's personification, anthropomorphism, there's all kinds of things. And then you have people who are mystics that view him as spirit to spirit, which is, I think, what Christianity was actually supposed to be in the beginning. We were talking about the book of the Watchers and all of this. It's very difficult to say this is a literal thing that happened or this is a literal thing that happened that was misinterpreted. There are many interpretations that say that the angels were actually possibly extraterrestrials. There's all kinds of interpretations based on the Book of the Watchers, which is the first book in the Book of Enoch. And we just don't really know what's going on. We know that in 200 BC, this book came to us in its current form. We don't know how long the oral tradition of the book existed. And we, when we interpret it, we come up with a different type of interpretation of what evil is, because we're taught in Christianity that we're fighting these demons.
Yes.
But if you read the book of Enoch quite carefully, you find out that the watchers were angels, and they came down, and they bred with women, and they taught mankind things that they weren't supposed to teach. But, Mike, they didn't leave. Mm-hmm. They weren't evil. They in the way that we think about it, they didn't leave. They didn't run off and leave their children. As a matter of fact, God threatens them and says, you've committed this sin, and now I know you love your children, but you've got to watch them die. And we come to a point in the book of Enoch where it seems that it's the offspring that actually are the problem, because the book says that being half corporeal and half spiritual. They had bodies, but when you killed them, the spirit left that body and went out in the wilderness and caused havoc and war, and it tormented people. And the book says, and I quote, they were not seen, they did not get hungry, they did not get thirsty, and they go around causing havoc.
Now, when you're looking back, and you've obviously made a lot of investigation because you're something of an expert on your own subject, where do you think the writings that come from Sumeria fit in? Because it seems quite apparent to me that a lot of those tablets that have been, if you like, it's not the correct word, but translated, are mentioning names which you can actually find in the Old Testament. So it would appear that a lot of those experiences of those people are in the Old Testament, and their gods were apparently, as far as I can see, ETs, who obviously weren't of the best kind, who allowed themselves to be thought of as gods. What do you think about that?
That is such an interesting question, because most people don't realize that there is a connection with these tablets, with these... Do you know Gilgamesh, the warrior,
yes,
king god Gilgamesh?
Yes.
Actually, his name appears as one of the fallen angels in one of the older texts.
Yes.
It is... And so, what do I think of it? I can only say this. At that particular time, somewhere back in history, we have a common well of wisdom that these books were written from and these stories came from, because they are intermingled. And it's much like the story of Noah, the flood story. You have a flood story in almost every single civilization. And it must be from a common wisdom well, if you will. And
yes,
there must be something that is that tracks back to that commonality.
Yes. It's certainly mentioned in the Sumerian tablets. And it would appear to fit in with this biblical story in the sense that the false gods were at some stage very annoyed with the people on earth, and they decided to create the flood, it would seem, as some sort of punishment to get rid of them.
Well, we believe that the flood may have been may not have really been global, but people from that area were spread abroad, so to speak, and they carried this thing with them.
Yes.
There was a major flood in the Middle East caused by a breach of an ocean wall, between an ocean wall and a lake, and that lake was filled in a matter of just moments, and it caused miles and miles of people living on that land to just disappear.
Right.
I don't know that that went worldwide, or if it happened all over the world, or if there was some odd event that was, as Carl Jung would say, synchronicity, all over the world that happened. But
yes,
to get to your point, it is really poignant, in my opinion, that the Bible refers to these men, these beings, as men of renown. In other words, men of legend. And who were the men of legend at that time? Well, Hercules, Achilles, and all of these demigods that had these, you know, powers that were humanoid, but not quite human. They were half god.
Right. So, I was going to say, are these the same gods, by definition, that the people of Greece used to worship?
I believe they may be. In their racial memory, I think that the memory of those may have continued. And that's how we get these kind of crossovers. you know, Gilgamesh was honestly, it had to be a crossover. There was a mighty king someplace. He had powers that people considered to be more than human. And I believe that his name pops up not only in the Sumerian records, but also the records in Qumran call his name out at least once as one of the heads of the fallen angels.
So all of these different books that you've referred to, the ones that were used for the Bible and the ones that were left out, I suppose it's true to say what they really were the history books of each of those nations or countries.
Certainly, that's how the Book of Jubilees is considered. It is an attempt to expand the history. And when you take a story and expand it, it's called a midrash writing. And yes, it is viewed exactly as an expansion of parts of Genesis, and it is historical, you know, according to the people who believe that the book is accurate and canon. A historical document regarding Israel, and its timeline is based on where the book gets its name, a series of jubilees. In other words, it's broken up into 50-year sections. And a week in the book is referred to, the week referred to is 7 years, and you have a week of weeks, and then you have a jubilee.
So, in your searching for all this information, what was the earliest biblical book that you ever found? I mean, where did this all start?
I don't know, and that's, I know that's an odd answer to someone who is supposed to understand these books, but you have writings that go back 4,000 years, 6,000 years, 4,000 B.C.
Right.
And, of course, you know, we have the oral traditions that precede those. But what happens, Mike, is that these things go through incarnations almost. They're added to and they're expanded on. So you have writing in the first part, for example, of the Book of Enoch that goes back to about 200 B.C., and then you have the last part that was probably added around, you know, some people think even around the time of Jesus or 100 A.D. The thoughts on those are quite divergent. But we're fairly sure that the starting of the Book of the Watchers probably came into being about 200 B.C. The question you have to ask yourself, I suppose, is, what source did they pin that from? What oral tradition, or did someone just sit down and make up the story, which is honestly something I do not believe. I believe that they had an oral tradition because it follows too close to a lot of things in Genesis.
I gather that in the different books that the Bible was composed of, there are stories very similar to the virgin birth, the crucifixion, and things like that, which may be unfortunate in the sense that I certainly believe that a great being called Jesus existed. But it throws some doubt on these stories about his life.
Honestly, absolutely. And it is a real, it is a problem. It gives me, personally, it gives me heartburn to try to figure out what's going on. But here's an example. In the caves, you had scrolls, but you also had other things. You had a copper scroll, and then you had something that people just don't want to discuss. It's called the Vision of Gabriel. It was penned approximately 60 years before Jesus. It is a piece of stone with ink writing on it. And in the story, which sometimes is hard to decipher because it becomes illegible, we have certain phrases that stand out that are legible. One of them is Gabriel talking to a person referred to, I believe, as the Teacher of Righteousness. That is a title given to the head of the Qumran community at the time, the Essenes. And he says, because this gentleman has been put to death and left on a ledge on a hill, and his body's decaying, and the angel Gabriel comes down and he says, in 3 days, live, Prince of Peace, dung of the craggy rock or the crevice. And so he is, what he's saying is, you're turning to dung, you're decomposing, but you are a Prince of Peace, and in 3 days you're going to be resurrected. So 60 years before Jesus, we have a resurrection story about a Teacher of Righteousness. It causes you to pause.
That's very interesting, isn't it? I suppose the more you've gone into it, the more controversial the biblical stories become. And I think that's a shame in some ways, because as I said a little earlier, I do really believe that Jesus was the great being and a world teacher, as some people refer to him as.
Well, I believe he is also, and I believe if we were to stick with, as Paul said, I come to you only knowing Christ and him crucified, then we are, I think we're quite safe. Here is a man sent from God, who some would say is God, who came to not only teach us how to live, but how to, you know, even die with grace, and he imparted wisdom and light to the world. Now, the rest of it may be up for grabs. The virgin birth, the resurrection, did he or did he not have children? Did he or did he not marry Mary Magdalene? All of these things are controversial, and people are discussing them for a change instead of being stoned to death for thinking them. But it does not in any way, shape, or form, in my opinion, take away from the divinity of the man.
Well, it's funny you should mention those aspects of the story of Jesus, because just recently, very recently, I had a lady on my program who alleges that she had contact with the spirit of Jesus, and questions were able to be asked of him about those particular things. And he did actually say, so she says, that he did have children, he did marry, and he also had a brother. And the answers to the questions, the sort of curiosity that people probably still have, were very interesting. Now, whether or not you believe that is possible, it's interesting to read those sort of answers. She wrote a book called A Question for Jesus. It isn't full of that part, because she talks about her life and how it all came about and so forth. But it is interesting that if you believe that type of communication is still valid today and has any reliability, then maybe it just throws a little bit of light on the situation.
Indeed. There, of course, are Gnostic Gospels of Mary Magdalene and Philip and Thomas and even the Gospel of Judas. And in the Gospel of Philip, I believe it is, he refers to Mary as having a special place in Jesus' life. And the text says, and he kissed her often on the... And then there's a hole in the text, and we can't tell what he kissed her on.
Oh, dear.
So we're assuming it was the mouth.
Yeah.
We're assuming it's the mouth, and they had a special relationship, but that's according to the Gospel of Philip.
Yeah.
And of course, all of these books that we're mentioning, if I can throw this in quickly, are available through Fifth Estate, and you can get them through Amazon.com, and if you'll Google Fifth Estate as the publisher or my name as the author, they will come up. And we have translations of the Book of Enoch and the Book of Jubilees and the Book of the Gospel of Thomas and Philip and Mary Magdalene and many, many more.
Right. Are you talking here of your books?
Yes.
You are. Right, fine. I know from the little write-up you sent in when you wanted to be a guest on a program, that you did mention your books, but I wasn't quite sure exactly what they were. It's beginning to look, the more you talk about it, as though the whole construct is really very confusing. Now, what is your personal belief? I mean, where do you stand, religion or otherwise? I mean,
well, I believe that my personal beliefs are very, very close to what they used to call the desert mystics, which is, I believe that religion is a man-made construct that really gets in the way between the person and God. And I believe part of the reason that we have the scriptures that we have is a slight manipulation, in that if you come across a scripture that says that, you know, man should seek God and have nothing to do, don't put a priest in the middle of it, don't put religion in the middle of it. Those books were sometimes called, for example, the Gospel of Thomas is very, very high on a personal spiritual relationship of seeking and finding the Master. And he talks about if you have a truth inside of you, and if you can bring it forth, it'll save you. But if you can't bring forth that truth inside of you, it will kill you. So the desert mystics went, I would say, beyond denomination, beyond religion, and sought the heart of Jesus. And I believe that if you were going to pin me down to a personal belief in one paragraph, that would be it. Denominations be damned. God is here now with us. Seek him here.
Right. I mean, the New Age teachings probably go even further by saying that you can find God within, which you're virtually leading.
I believe he is within. You know, the Book of Thomas says if you are told to seek God in the heavens, the birds will have entered in before you. And if you are taught to seek God below, then the fish will get there before you. But God is within, and the kingdom of heaven is in you. That does not in any way go against the teachings of Christ, I don't believe. He part of the problem that he had with the establishment was that he was telling people, this is it. I am the truth, the way, and the light. You don't need anything else except what I'm telling you right now. And what did he tell us? He gave us two rules. He broke everything down to two rules. Love God, love each other. The rest is commentary.
Yes, I can certainly go along with that. I mean, with my own beliefs, that certainly makes a lot of sense. Then, what do you think we should be doing today? Because we seem to be in a period of great change. There are a lot of prophecies that in a couple of years or so, we may well reach a point of ascension. Is that something that figures in your thinking?
Are you asking me if I believe that we can become ascended beings? Is that your question?
Yes, indeed, yes.
I don't see it happening anytime soon, but I believe the answer is yes. I believe that we can indeed become the spiritual beings that we need to become. But I don't think that our evolutionary course of simply losing the body is going to be manifest anytime soon. I do believe that there are those that in death find that transition and transition. They find the ascension to heaven, if you will, or whatever you think heaven may be.
Yes. So what is your view about the belief that man is made in the image of God?
I think it has to be taken in context. I believe that spiritually, here's something that gives a lot of Christians some headache. Jesus is talking to to the Pharisee, and he's quoting from a psalm, and he says, "Does not your scriptures tell you ye are all gods?" Mm. And so, do I believe that we are made in the image of God? Yeah, I truly, truly do. Spiritually, if we were to somehow go beyond our fear and our prejudice and our selfishness, if we were to lose selfishness and fear, we would find that we really do have the mind of Christ, as the scriptures say. You know, let this mind be in you, the mind of Christ. Our problem, yeah, I think, is that we are earthbound partly because of our society and partly because of our inability to let go of self.
Yes, I can go along with that. I'm guessing that for some people, the expression of us being made in the image of God leads them to believe that God is a being such as us, whereas I think it's quite the reverse. We are the image of God, as you're hinting, I think, from a spiritual point of view, not the physical body.
Absolutely. I think that if you go in the other direction, you anthropomorphize. I don't think, well, for example, Jesus is talking to Jerusalem, basically. He's on the hill, he's weeping, and he looks down.
Hello, we seem to have lost you. I don't know if we've lost him or lost me. Just hope you can pick that up in the studio. I don't know whether my listeners can hear me, but if we've lost Joseph, we'll pick him up again, or if it's me, I suppose.
Hi, you reached Joseph Lumpkin. Please leave me your name and number and the time.
Okay, right, fine. I'm okay. Yeah, yes, so bearing in mind he's doing this from his car, perhaps something's happened, perhaps he's had to move it or somebody's interfered. But hopefully, when he's cleared the problem, you can pick him up again on that number. Well, I'll still hold on in touch with you, waiting for a call back, but I don't need to take a personal break at the moment. I'll just keep listening in to see if you've made a recontact with him. I think it would be nice if you put something on until we can sort out whether the program can continue. Yes, indeed. Hello, everyone. We're sorry about that break there. Something happened to Dr. Joseph Lumpkin, but I gather we've now made a contact with him again. Are you there, Joseph?
I am, yes. Thank you.
Oh, fine. Okay. I'm glad we found you again. I don't know quite what happened there, but that's brilliant. Are you okay for about the next, where are we? About 12, 13 minutes, which will take us up to the last few minutes of the show.
That will be fine. I've got my group kind of waiting outside, and we're traveling to give a seminar, so we're just pulled over here waiting.
Right, I must say, it's so wonderful of you to accept the invitation to come on at such short notice. I know you were originally prepared to, but I was very pleased to know that you were in the wings and might be able to help us. Now, we had got as far as talking about this question of humans being made in the image of God. Had you any other comments to make about that?
Actually, no, because, you know, any comment that I make would be personal speculation, and of course my own belief is that we are spiritually made in his image. I suppose possibly, Mike, there is one comment, and this is kind of off the wall, but recently brain research has found that if you run a small magnetic pulse behind around the ear in one hemisphere, it will actually give you a sense that you are being watched over, that there's an entity there, some intelligence. And some people, when they're exposed to this, they weep and they say that they felt God, and some actually become somewhat paranoid and talk about demons and angels and such. Mm. And it has brought to us the question, why are we wired to be a spiritual being? And I don't think anyone's ever really asked that. Why is it that God appears in all civilizations, and all people have this belief that that there might be, you know, something greater? You know, you have people who are atheists, and I want to acknowledge that they don't believe that anything greater exists. But most of us believe that there is something that's greater, and that that's been called the God gene, that people have the God gene. In other words, they have this thing in their brain that actually perceives something mystical, and it can be actually triggered. So my question is this. Mm-hmm. If form follows function, which in evolution it must, then why has form followed this function? What form, what purpose is there that we should believe in God? Now, if you are a creationist, intelligent design person, the answer is axiomatic. But I leave that just as an open question to the people who might not know that experimentation is going on. Google it, research it for yourself, and ask yourself the question, why are we wired to believe in God to a great degree?
Well, I guess my answer would be that I think everybody subconsciously knows that there is a God. For some, the knowledge surfaces and they feel it very strongly. Perhaps with an atheist, it's still rather dormant. If we have all been created by God, then it would seem odd, maybe, that we didn't feel, even if it was subconsciously, that there was something there.
I agree wholeheartedly with that statement, and I have nothing to add to it. I think you said it all.
Right. I think, furthermore, that we haven't approached the question of reincarnation, but if we have whole series of lives, then one might presume that the whole object of that is to evolve spiritually.
Well, there's actually hints of this in the Bible that we see. Jesus was asked, "Are you Elijah?" And he said, no. And then he said that John the Baptist came in the spirit of Elijah. And so you have these hints that possibly reincarnation was on the minds of the writers at that time.
Yes. Of course, I mean, at some stage, belief in reincarnation was declared a heresy, wasn't it?
Absolutely, sure. They say to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord, and a man dies only once, and they quote all these scriptures that truly are kind of taken out of context. Just because to be absent from the body is to be present from the Lord doesn't mean that you can have another body and be absent from heaven at that time. The Jews believed in what they called the Guph, G-U-F or G-U-P-H, and it was a storehouse for the souls, because everything being taken literally, you must acknowledge the fact that if everything was created in 6 days, then that means that the spirits of everyone who will ever exist or who has ever existed must have been created at the same time. And the storehouse of those souls near the throne of God is called the Guph. And when the Guph is empty, when all souls have been incarnated, then we have the end of mankind. Now, do they come and go from the Guph is the question.
I personally believe that our evolutionary path is actually returning to the source.
The Zohar says that you are correct. The Zohar is a mystical Jewish writing, and it literally says that that the Jews especially are, and I'm going to paraphrase, as burning embers emitted from the fire of God, and when all embers return to God and the fire is restored whole, time stands still, time stops.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? not coincidence, but you can have these different views, and you found some example in somebody's writing. So there are these myriads of opinions and views and stories about it. So our own experience, we hope, is going to lead us to the truth, isn't it? And that is difficult to find.
I believe that the problem is that we have a tendency to be so subjective, which, you know, indeed we are made to be subjective. But if we could take our prejudice, if you will, out of the picture and say we are one people and we are mankind, and what we're doing here is looking at God through different lenses, let us put these things together and find a fuller picture of what God may be, we'd be a lot better off than to break apart into our denominational partisan beliefs.
Right. Now, I think when the program's finished, they will be able to edit out the break, so we still have time to complete our 55 minutes, as far as I'm aware. So there's an aspect of your books that we haven't spoken about, which I'm interested to know your opinion of, and that is demons. Where do they fit in, if they exist at all?
Interesting question, and I address this in a book called Fallen Angels, The Watchers and the Origins of Evil. And here is what I know, or what I think I know, from the ancient text. And this will be putting Enoch, Jubilee, Jasher, and other items, as well as the Bible, together into a narrative. We believe, and I'll try to make this quick, that the fallen angels were here to watch, record, and teach. Somehow they came to the lust that was in them for the women of the earth. They came down. They had children. They stayed. They taught. They taught things that were not meant to be taught, charms and spells and astrology. astronomy and astrology and herbology and war and metallurgy and writing even. And then they produced children. And these children were half-breeds. They weren't supposed to exist. And those children actually, it looks like, became what we would refer to as the demons. They went out when their bodies were killed. And God saw such a problem that he killed all of them in the flood. That's one interpretation of why the flood existed. And so these spirits went out from these bodies, and they became what we would consider to be demons. They went about causing turmoil and havoc and hauntings, the scriptures say that they slept not and they were not hungry, and they tormented men. And then all of a sudden everything starts making sense in the Bible. You think, why did they do that? For example, the king was told to go into a land and kill everything that had breath, leave nothing alive. And this was the area of the earth where these demons were killed. And he didn't do that. He brought back animals, he said, for sacrifice and different things. And we think that possibly these demons inhabited the land, and God was trying to make it so that they had nothing to inhabit. And it didn't work because we were disobedient. So here we are later, and we have the demonic man of Gadarenes. And what did the demons want to do when they were challenged? The legion of angels, the legions of demons, I should say, cried for permission to go into the pigs. And it just seems very, very odd that all these things happen. But if you read the ancient writings, it begins to make sense that they came from animals, and they go back to animals. And when they can inhabit a human, they are called demons.
Yes, yeah. Right, fine. Now, I reckon we must be coming near the last 4 minutes of the program. I'd like to give you an opportunity to give our listeners your website address, your email address, if you wish to give it out. So would you like to sort of take the next 2 minutes or so doing that?
That would be fine. I would appreciate that. Our website is www.fifthestatepub.com or www.fifth-estate.net. And there they will be directed to our books, and there's actually a link that says if you're in the UK, you can buy our books here. If you're in the US, you can buy our books here. And there'll be links to all over the world to distributors that will handle our books. We have the Book of Enoch. Actually, we just finished 1, 2, and 3 Enoch. We are, I think, one of the only two people two publishers available that actually handle the third book of Enoch. And so you can get first book, second book, and third book in one volume. We put out an encyclopedia. And, Mike, we actually have done something very, very audacious, very odd. We have published a Bible with 93 books in it. It has the canon of the Protestant, Catholic, Orthodox, Ethiopic, Samaritan churches, all in the same book. And as far as I know, it's the first time that that's ever been done.
It would undoubtedly interest some people who would like to compare, perhaps, what the teachings are. Fine.
Yes.
Does that cover what you want to say? What about your email address? Would you just prefer to keep that to yourself?
They can email me at josephlumpkin@hotmail.com.
Right. Fine. There may be some people who, having heard what you have to say, would like to contact you. That invariably takes place, I think, but not everybody wants to give their email address out. I think that's probably time for me to say thank you very much for coming on, and I'm really so grateful that you really saved us a major problem there. So I feel sorry for our guest who should have been on, because it rather sounds as though he was taken quite seriously ill overnight. So if he's listening in at all, I wish him a speedy recovery. All it remains for me to do now, and thanks again, Dr. Joseph, for coming on, is to tell you that next week I've got Jack Alice, who's an author and spiritual teacher, and what we're going to talk about is prophecy, challenge and blessing, which covers visions of 2012 and the shift. So he's been on before, he's a wonderful speaker, and I'm looking forward to it myself. So thank you for being with us today, sorry about the little delays, and I hope you can be with us next week. Bless you all, thank you.